title of this session is Entertainment Evangelism and the Christian Meal. I want to start this morning with just a little excerpt from O Ye Jigs and Juleps. This was written by Virginia Carey Hudson when she was 10 years old, and it was published first in 1904. 1904. She lived in Leesville, Virginia. There is a Leesville, and a teacher in her school found some of these essays, and they were later printed, and it's a bestseller now. I think our bookstore has some, but I want to read the section called Etiquette in Church. Before I go into the house of the Lord with praise and thanksgiving, I lift up mine eyes unto the town clock, from whence cometh the time, to see if I am late. It is not etiquette to be late. Do not hop, skip, jump, or slide in the church vestibule. Tip, tip all the way to your seat. Be sure and do not sit in other people's pews. Jesus wouldn't care, but other people would. Paying money makes it yours to sit in. The first thing you do is kneel down and thank the Lord for your mother and your father and your breakfast and your lunch and your dinner and your lovely wallpaper and your new pink garter belt. Then you can sit and look around just a little bit, but don't turn around and look. That is not etiquette. Kneel when you pray, stand when you sing, sit when you listen. On Communion Sunday, take off your right glove and leave it in the pew. Don't wait till you get to the rail and the body and blood comes around. And don't try to drink up all of the wine. That is not etiquette. Leave some for other people. Never punch anybody in church, or giggle, or cross your legs. Crossing your legs is as bad as scratching, or walking in front of somebody, or chewing gum, or saying damn. Don't lose your place in the prayer book. The Baptist church is next door to our church. They sing as loud as they can all the time we are trying to pray. I bet the Lord can't hear one word we say. The Baptists sing about plunging sinners in a bloody fountain drawn from Emmanuel's veins. We sing about crown him Lord of all. I think it is more ladylike to crown the king than to go plunging around in a bloody fountain. So I took the cotton off my sore finger once and stuffed it in my ear on the Baptist side. But just once, my mother attended to that. Of all the people who come to church, I love Mrs. Harris best. Mrs. Harris lets me churn. She has a lot of cows that give milk and one that doesn't and is mean. I asked her why she kept that one, and she said, "He is a necessity." All the other cows have names. All the other cows have names, but that one, and everything should have a name. So I got me a shingle and painted Mr. Necessity on it. And nailed it on the gate where the gentleman cow stays. Mrs. Harris said she just didn't understand why she didn't think of that herself. Etiquette is what you are doing and saying when people are looking and listening. What you are thinking is your business. Thinking is not etiquette. Hallelujah, thine be the glory, revive us again. P.S. If you want to stay awake in church, go to bed early Saturday night. You can't go to the altar until you are 12. That is God's etiquette. And you can't put on perfume until you are 16. That is Leesville etiquette. After you are confirmed, your sponsors in baptism can't be blamed for what you do. You are on your own then, and if the devil gets you, it's your own fault and serves you just right. Amen, and the Lord have mercy. Isn't this fun? We'll read another one tomorrow. She's got one on baptism that is just as funny. Virginia Carey Hudson. Well, today we're going to talk about entertainment evangelism and the Christian meal. I wanted to say just a little bit by way of introduction that what we're doing when we critique various proposals is not to say that there is nothing that can't be learned from them. Critique is more like analysis. What's going on here? And that's part of what I tried to do yesterday. I tried to ask what kind of gospel is behind the church growth movement, especially as it expresses itself in the so-called mega churches, and then tried to compare that with the way in which the word gospel is used in the New Testament. Come on in. There's lots of room over here, and you can walk around this way. It doesn't mean to do critique then, or to do critique and analysis, comparing what the way in which the word gospel is used in the New Testament with the kind of gospel that one often finds in church growth. Doesn't mean that our tradition, whatever it might be, is doing everything all right. I'm mostly concerned with what ought to be, not with what is. Often people ask me, what are the trends, you know, where are things headed? I don't really know, and I don't care. I mean, if this is a trend right now, that's all right, but I care very much about what ought to be, no matter what the trends are. I think the question, really, for Christians always has to be, what is true? And sometimes what is true may not be the trend at all, or it may not be what is going on. So today I want to talk about worship especially, and evangelism. A couple of years ago, Walter Kallestad, who is the pastor of Community Church of Joy in Phoenix, Arizona, wrote a column for the Lutheran, in which it's a column entitled Viewpoint, and the piece was called Entertainment Evangelism. It evoked the largest number of letters that I think the Lutheran has ever gotten, and this is what Kallestad said. I want to read the whole piece to you. The key to reaching our world with the good news of Jesus is entertainment evangelism. That's his term. It is time for the Christian church to become serious about penetrating the heart of the culture with the heart of the gospel. Entertainment evangelism is a clear call for Christians in the church to stop talking to ourselves and judging the world, and to start talking to the world and to begin judging ourselves. How do we talk to the world? What is getting the world's attention? Where are the world's values being developed? The answer is entertainment. It is the medium of our day. It is a mega $1 million a year enterprise. People will stand in line all night to get a ticket for their favorite rock band or athletic event. Recently, a major motion picture grossed more than $100 million in one weekend. The entertainment industry will continue to grow larger and become more powerful, and the Christian church needs to learn how to use this powerful tool to accomplish Christ's mandate, go into all the world and make disciples. Sunday morning is the time for congregations to bring in the 60% to 90% unchurched, unreached population. Sunday morning is a prime time to seek and to save the lost. The problem is that church people have been taught that Sunday mornings can only be used to teach, train, inspire, and equip Christians. Church people tend to want only their needs to be met instead of the needs of the unchurched. Christians should design Sunday nights for themselves and turn the morning over to evangelistic outreach. The reason most churches do not grow, and in fact begin to decline, is because they are unwilling to put the needs of the lost ahead of their own. Sunday morning they sing hymns only traditional Christians know. They use religious language that only Christians can understand. Sermons are preached that become dull, boring, uninteresting to the lost because they don't have any assumed prior knowledge. Churchy rites and rituals are practiced. Sure, much of our traditional heritage has meaning and value, but only to those who understand by having been indoctrinated to it. If we are absolutely honest, what most churches do on Sunday morning is not working. We can give profound theological reasons why we have to do what we do. However, if what we are doing doesn't work, let the Spirit show us new and different ways to reach people with the good news of Jesus Christ. Entertainment-oriented churches are growing. The do what we have always done before churches are dying. When people come to Community Church of Joy on Sunday morning, they have fun. We may have a stage band, comedians, clowns, dramas, mini concerts, productions, high energy choreography, as well as many other entertainment forms. One thing that is always present is a simple, enthusiastic message about the unconditional love and the unlimited grace and transformational cross-centered salvation power of Jesus Christ. It is time for radical reform of Sunday mornings. God is calling for a new day in the church. The Spirit will help us clearly see what God is up to in 1990 and beyond. The Bible emphasizes this in the words, "Behold, I am doing a new thing. Do you not perceive it?" What was relevant in the 16th century in terms of the medium of the day is not relevant today. Certainly, the changeless message remains the same. It is a matter of stylistic change, not substance change. Entertainment is a gift of God. Entertainment evangelism will fill our churches. Augustine said, "Empty churches do not please God." We are not called simply to build buildings. We are called to fill buildings. There has never been a more critical time when creative, innovative, clear thinking is needed about effectively communicating to the world about Christ, the cross, the church. If Jesus were here today, walking the face of the earth, he would without a doubt use the number one medium of the day to tell his story. Jesus would become all things to all people in order to save some. He would use entertainment. Well, what do you say to that? Do you find church dull, boring, and do you think only your needs are being met? How would you respond to Pastor Kallestad? Anybody?
I think he has some valid points.
Name what you think is valid. I mean, I try to identify
that.
Well,
I think that churches tend to speak to the choir, you might say, and you have to have an outreach, and you have to appeal to more of them.
Mm-hmm. Good. Yeah, I think so. I think that's right.
I think, and I think the Lutheran Church were sort of average middle class people, and we like things to be very orderly, and don't want too many amens, and
Absolutely, right, yes.
And a lot of people, this is very unappealing to, and a lot of people are not ready to change any of these things.
Good point. Anybody else? How do you respond to this proposal? If you were going to write a letter to the Lutheran, what would you say? Bill Hybels, 15,000 people crowded into an auditorium listening, watching a drama, huh?
That's not a replace. That does not replace a worship service for me.
I don't know how many of us we are. I always thought that I was one of us, as you described, you know, people in the room.
Yeah.
Most of us deeply immersed in our congregations and worshiping and have a spiritual life that we consider really important and more or less thriving. But I had an opportunity to travel and visit about 10 different churches, all Lutheran churches, in a short period of time. And I had an 18-month-old and an 8-year-old. And each time I went to a church, I was a visitor, even my home church, but I went to the church with expectations of being fed while I was there. And each time I went away feeling like, I will never return to this church. If I wasn't a minister's wife and I wasn't committed to showing up every Sunday, I would not come back. This was
okay.
the whole feeling I came back from my travels with. I was just weeping inside because if I wasn't really dedicated to being there, you wouldn't find me back. No place Did I find what I was searching for? Whatever that was. And if that's just a tiny glimpse of what an outsider would see, we've got a big job ahead of us.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
How many of you share some of these things? Back there, please.
Elizabeth, I feel the same way. I'm really involved in restructuring education. And you're kind of thinking about the people that keep it like it is. It was fine for me. And then you've got the forward thinking people who kind of do this, put more creativity into this. What can we do?
Uh-huh.
And I feel very much the same that the church I'm involved with. I think of myself as very creative and wanting to really put some pizzazz in there.
Uh-huh.
So I kind of. No, I think
it could
be
more. Uh-huh. Bill, you're from Phoenix. You are right next door to the Community Church of Joy. Tell us what it's really like.
It's a lot like Bill Ivers. Bringing in about probably 6,000 to 8,000 people on a Sunday morning. They have a Wednesday evening thing that they try to say, ask, you know, if you're Christians, you know, if you come to the Wednesday night thing to be fed. The Sunday morning is for people who are seeking, but you know, if there's no ticket there, you can't stop or come. But it is highly energized. Much of it is very showy. You know, they got bands. They do not use a green book at all. In fact, the last time I was there, I wasn't even in the pews. Just like you saw, probably a little more, less like Hybels and more like the one we saw with the guy coming out. We did the ten top reasons why you should go to church, you know. So,
or what ten top things you do in a boring sermon.
Yeah, that's it. A little more like that. However, he does ask some really fine questions and issues. You know, we ought to find out why people don't go to church and try to deal with those kinds of issues. You know, I've heard people have lots of excuses. But once you get the excuses taken care of, the reasons are a lot more traumatic and dramatic. And if you can address the reasons, then people are more apt to might hang around for a while.
Mm-hmm.
What you saw at Hybels thing, pretty much what they do there.
Please.
My husband and I went to this church in March. Very entertainment oriented. They had a country western band on a Saturday night, and it was enjoyable. But the thing that struck me is after the service, they mentioned that they have a prayer chapel for those who would like to go pray there, or they have people available to pray with. And this struck my husband and I wonderfully. We were visiting my mother who was suffering from cancer, so the three of us went into the prayer chapel. And what a wonderful thing to offer. I think I have sent for information on their prayer ministry program, and they have a vast prayer ministry. Matter of fact, that is their base foundation, is their prayer ministry. They have courses available for people, just wide variety of things as far as prayer ministry. So I do think they're into entertainment, but I don't think that's their only focus. I mean, they have a lot of real interesting things happening there.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that was our experience.
I want to get to work on this today, and so I'm going to just move us along. The first thing I wanted to do is to start with his premise that entertainment is the way in which values are being shaped, the way in which attention is cultivated. I brought along with me today Neil Postman's book, Amusing Ourselves to Death, Public Discourse in the Age of Show Business. And one of the things that Postman does here is to analyze the power of television on our lives. And I think Kallestad is very right in the place where he begins. I just want to read what Postman does here is to contrast two futures, two projections of the future of the world, both of them coming out of the 1930s. One was Aldous Huxley's Brave New World, right, in which we would all be entertained and comforted to death. And the other is George Orwell's 1984. He says we all breathed a sigh of relief when 1984 came and went, and it didn't happen. So the worst did not happen, the nightmare. But now he contrasts these. He says what Orwell feared were those who would ban books. What Huxley feared is that there would be no reason to ban a book because nobody wanted to read one anymore. Orwell feared those who would deprive us of information. Huxley feared those who would give us so much that we would be reduced to passivity and egoism. Orwell feared that the truth would be concealed from us. Huxley feared that the truth would be drowned in a sea of irrelevance. Orwell feared that we would become a captive culture. Huxley feared we would become a trivial culture, preoccupied with some equivalent of the feelies, the orgy porgy, and the centrifugal bumble puppy. As Huxwell remarked in Brave New World Revisited, the civil libertarians and rationalists who were ever on the alert to oppose tyranny failed to take into account our almost infinite appetite for distractions. In 1984, Huxley added, people are controlled by inflicting pain. In Brave New World, they are controlled by inflicting pleasure. In short, Orwell feared that what we hate will ruin us. Huxley feared that what we love will ruin us. This book is about the possibility that Huxley and not Orwell was right. So what does happen? He says television is the supreme medium of entertainment. It transforms everything it touches into entertainment. So he looks at four areas that have been transformed by television: politics, news, education, and religion. Politics, he says, has become largely a form of entertainment. Lincoln and Douglas debated the question of slavery for 8 straight hours before 2,000, 3,000 people who would stand all day in the rain to participate in these 8-hour debates. We want 30-second spots. We want a 15-second soundbite. Politics has been transformed into image-making. The last 2 presidential candidates to write their own speeches were Adlai Stevenson and Dwight Eisenhower. And you remember, I remember this campaign very vividly. It was 1952. I was a seminary student just about to go on, well, I was on internship, and television was a brand new medium. My pastor, my supervising pastor, had a television set. I had never seen one before in my life. He would invite me up occasionally just to watch this strange new thing. Stevenson went to various parts of the country and gave reasoned speeches which could be printed in a book and still read as helpful. He talked about the farm problem at Casson-Manterville plowing contest in Minnesota. And he didn't say what farmers wanted to hear either. I mean, his campaign was trying to talk sense to the American people. Now, he lost the election, but his speeches are still worth reading. Eisenhower's were less publishable. I think Eisenhower is a very shrewd president and a very good administrator, very much on top of things, but he sort of projected a different image, and we went for it. People then analyzed the Eisenhower image and started hiring image makers. What we vote for now are not so much presidential candidates as their image makers. And that's what Postman says has happened to politics. What happened to news? He entitles that chapter, Now Hear This. And our news reporters are, again, primarily entertainers. who look at ratings, and a really in-depth story on the evening news is likely to last 3 minutes. Whew, in-depth. You see, what we are getting are headlines. We are, in fact, inundated by what Huxley says is too much information. And it all finally runs together so that the headlines can hardly be distinguished anymore from the commercials. It's just sort of one thing after another, and a famine in Africa or an earthquake in Russia gets mixed in with Advil commercials, and all you do is take a pop an Advil into your mouth and you can deal with famine and earthquake and assassination and terror and hijackings and who knows what all. And it suddenly somehow doesn't make any difference at all. The worst thing to happen to education, Huxley says, is Sesame Street. Sesame Street, we love it. I mean, it's wonderful. Set our kids in front of the television sets, and they might even learn the numbers in the alphabet before they get to school. The problem is, he says, is that education is finally not simply entertainment. Bert and Ernie are not going to help you master calculus. And the big chicken or whatever it is, Big Bird, I was close. Big Bird isn't going to help you get the state capitals down or the countries of Africa or something like that. The problem is that if we expect education to be without sweat, without hard work, if we come with that expectation, it'll be much more difficult for us to become learners, that is, people for whom education is hard work, rewarding work in the end, but nevertheless hard work. How do you memorize the Greek verbs, for example, when you go off to seminary? Well, again, Bert and Ernie aren't really gonna do the job. But we ought to memorize Greek verbs, and especially if we're going to be pastors and preachers. Then he gets to religion, and he says, what happens now when religion is taken over by television? He says it's transformed into entertainment because it has to compete with everything else. You have 15 seconds or less to catch somebody's attention who's sitting there with a remote control button and is just flicking for one thing or another that they're going to like. And so you got to grab people. That's Jerry Falwell's issue. That's D. James Kennedy's problem. That's Oral Roberts' problem. That's what Robert Schuller has to do. Got to grab you quick. Now, he raises then the hard question, what happens when religion is taken over by a medium like entertainment? He says it stops being religion. In the same way that education stops being education, news stops being news, the New York Times isn't going to entertain you. It's going to it's a wonderful newspaper. We were in New York last September to December. I was teaching, and every morning I made my walk to the newsstand a block and a half away, plunked down my 50 cents at first, then it went to 65, got my New York Times and came over, and it occupied me for the next hour or so while I just learned a lot and put it aside because there were many things in there that I wanted to read. It was not, however, entertaining. It didn't grab me. News transformed into entertainment stops being informative, and politics, etc. So one needs to be very, very careful. Entertainment is not a neutral medium. It has its own power and its own ability. It may well be that there is much wrong with our worship today, but it may also be that entertainment is not exactly the medicine that it needs. And that's what I want to pay some attention to. I think the problem involved is that entertainment reduces us largely to being audience, And a lot of the people who write and who speak on church growth use that term to describe what it is that we are. Now, one of the problems is that traditional liturgy has also made us audience. My father and my grandfathers were pastors. Sunday morning was a ritual in my home as a boy. My father wore a wing collar when I was a boy and a silver striped tie and a black suit, wore a black gown, marched out of the sacristy at appropriate times in the Sunday service, did his thing. Pastors were taught that when they faced the altar, they were talking to God. When they faced the congregation, they were talking for God. Boy, that was really awesome. But basically, as a congregation, the question was, did we like it? You know, you'd go home and have roast pastor for dinner on Sunday, along with the roast chicken. How did we like it? Boy, we all got to be critics. Did we like the sermon? Did we like the choice of hymns? My father usually selected the hymns on Thursday, phoned them to the organist, so he had Friday and Saturday to practice. And the congregation was critic. See, did we like the hymns? Did we like the sermon? Did we like the pastor's voice? You sort of almost cultivated a special chancel voice for Sunday mornings. And it was, in fact, a religious performance. The really odd thing is that that's one of the things that the Reformation was against. The Mass as a drama up there with the people watching in the pews, probably saying their beads while the priest was doing his special things up there. But the churches were built almost literally to be stages for this great medieval drama of the Mass. Luther had an entirely different idea in mind, and that was that the liturgy was something done by the people. Not to them or for them, but by them. That is, that you come on Sundays to do your liturgy. I think it's very interesting that you commented on the prayer place that Community Church of Joy has. I think that's marvelous. But what you are asking for is that you come and do something. See, you do your praying. I think one of the things that happened with the Lutheran Book of Worship and that can happen with all of the books that are being introduced is that they give us only different music for doing the same old thing, which is that we come to be acted upon. We come to have clergy or choirs or organists do something to us or for us while we just sort of sit there and then go home and roast the performance after church on Sundays. So one of the things I want to ask about is how does what we do on Sundays become our activity and therefore also, in a sense, our witness to the people who come as guests and visitors and observers. I keep wanting to ask, too, is anything going on in my church on Sunday to which I even want to invite anybody? Is something happening there that I really want people to see and to experience? If you go to a Hybels church or maybe a Community Church of Joy and are part of an audience, it can move you, it can make the time pass more quickly. Remember this man yesterday who said, seems too short. He says, I think it ought to be at least as long as a movie. But again, notice what he compared it to. Right? Now, again, I'm trying to say maybe both what goes on in the traditional liturgy and what goes on in the exciting kinds of places that attract big crowds, both need to be looked at from a different perspective. And the place where I want to start is with where I ended yesterday, or where we ended yesterday. What is the Christian gospel? The good news of the New Testament is some variation on phrases like Jesus is risen, or Jesus is the Messiah, or the reign of God has come. Notice a couple of things. First of all, these are not ideas. These are announcements about something that has taken place. They are news in the best sense of the word. Now, the New York Times goes out of date within a day or two. I can pick up yesterday's New York Times and not even miss the fact that I haven't looked at the day before, or the day before that, or the day before that. Within a day or two, the news is out of date. The one thing that is not out of date is the news, Jesus is risen. If, in fact, that's true, then the world is forever changed. The history of the world is forever changed. It is always news to announce that the death rate is not one death per person, that something has happened. You see, Jesus of Nazareth is risen and has death behind him. Therefore, to be connected with him means you are changed as well as the world being changed. Now, the other thing that is part of the Christian good news is that we retrieve the cross of Jesus, so that, as Arlen Hultgren puts it, cross and resurrection now become one event. But what is the cross about? The cross says Jesus dies not in order that God be merciful, but because God insists on being merciful. The scandal that got everybody's teeth on edge was that Jesus insisted on being merciful to a lot of people whom the Pharisees and the scribes didn't think deserved it. The paralytic, see, he's being punished for his sins, he thinks, and everybody. So Jesus says to him, your sins are forgiven. And then he gets up and walks. Or Zacchaeus, come down from the tree, Zacchaeus. I'm going to eat at your house today, which was the highest honor that a rabbi could pay to a corrupt political shyster, as Elmer Witt called him last week. And this make people mad. See, it was because Jesus insisted on being merciful that he got a one-way ticket to the cross. Or at least they thought it was a one-way ticket. See, it was because his vision was God is merciful. God is going to include all of Israel. The Pharisees thought Messiah would come when everybody obeyed Torah. All Jews obeyed Torah for one day. Well, they were not likely to have sinners obeying Torah, so they lopped them off, and they lopped off all kinds of people in order to make it possible that just maybe, all Israel would obey Torah and Messiah would come. Jesus comes with a different vision, and you can see it in Ezekiel 34, where the prophet there rails against those who were the shepherds of Israel, but were the false shepherds. So when Jesus says he is going to be the shepherd of Israel, this is what the prophet talks about when he says God himself will be your shepherd, you see, and will gather all of the sheep. So Jesus is crucified because of his messianic vision, and the resurrection is the vindication of it. This is why the women are terrified when they go to the tomb and find it empty. What if it's all true? What if this really is the way God intends to be Messiah. And now comes a community out of the resurrection. The church belongs essentially to the gospel. One of the things that is a problem with church growth is that in the end it is not about church. It is about highly individualistic ways in which we can be served, in which our needs can be met. Kallestad talks about that here. He says the church is not about meeting our needs. Right on that point, it is about meeting the needs of those outside of the church. Well, there I want to start raising questions. Jesus is not so much about meeting needs as about holding up before the world a vision of what life will be like if death does not have the last word. That's what we're called to portray. That is what the church is called to portray. What will humanity be like if life and not death has the last word? So the church is called to look like and to be like what all of humanity will look like and be like if life and not death has the last word. That's, I think, reasonably exciting in itself already. What if we are called to look like and be like what all of humanity will be like if life has the last word, if God and the reign of God are to have the last word? So, what did these disciples of Jesus do? Right after the resurrection, they start celebrating the Messiah's banquet. Robert read that this morning at Matins, the theme Vespers lesson about the great banquet on the feast on the Mount of the Lord, when all nations will be gathered and feast on fat things. Garrison Keillor says, don't be oppressed by waitists. Think of yourself as a total person, and of thin people is not all there. Oh, boy, I'm getting ready for the feast. I'm more all there than I was 20 years ago, and it's wonderful. Anyway, so a feast of fat things and of wine, well-refined, a party, in short. Here they are. What do we read about these Christians in the book of Acts? They gather, they go to the temple, like they always did as good Jews, and they go to synagogue, but when they want to be Jesus' disciples, they gather for the breaking of bread and the prayers and the apostles' teaching and the koinonia, the enveloping, all-embracing gathering of the people. At the heart of it is a meal. This is a crazy thing to do. No other religious tradition does this, because no other religious tradition believes Jesus is the Messiah. Only Christians believe this. And therefore, only Christians, when they come together, do a meal. If your gathering doesn't have bread and wine, it's still more like synagogue than it is like church. It's more like mosque, you see, than it is like church. The mosque and the synagogue read scriptures and have prayers and have sermons. They don't have a meal because they don't believe Jesus is the Messiah. What we are witnessing to when we say Jesus is the Messiah, or what we are doing when we witness to Jesus as the Messiah, is the meal. That's one thing. The second thing that Christians do, which is really funny, is we offer ourselves. We put ourselves on the table along with the bread and the wine. We say it in so many words in the prayers. We offer with joy and thanksgiving what you have first given us, ourselves, our time, and our possession. See, ticket takers collect money at the door. Jan and I go to Stratford every summer, to Stratford, Ontario, for the Shakespeare Festival. One year they did T.S. Eliot's Murder in the Cathedral. People paid $50 Canadian for a sermon. Boy, I thought to myself, we're doing it all wrong. We ought to take tickets at the door. We ought to say, $50, please. We're going to hear a sermon today. They'd come in droves, you know. We're not doing that. We are not doing that when we pass the collection plates. We are actually asking people not just simply to pay for the preaching. We are asking them to give themselves. I was in Johannesburg, South Africa in 1992, and one of the best things that happened to us there in the 2 weeks of meetings was that we went on Sunday morning to the Anglican Church of the Holy Cross and on Sunday afternoon to the big Lutheran Cathedral for ordinations. The Sunday morning service at Holy Cross was 3 hours long, and I didn't notice it. I mean, it was so wonderful and so vibrant. But one of the things that happened was a woman came up at the time for the offering with a great big woven offering basket and stood there in the front in this gorgeous dashiki and held this big basket. And then the choir started singing some gyrating music, and then people came forward, a huge line of them. There were thousands of people there that morning, and they came forward to put money in that basket. They offered themselves along with the money. They had a procession. They didn't have boutonniered ushers marching forward with the plates piled high and give them to a trembling acolyte who doesn't quite know what to do with them and looks to the pastor to see what to do. They came forward and put money in this basket. They did the same thing in the afternoon at the ordination service. It was wonderful. Nobody could tell me that these people didn't come there to do something, you see. Not to be an audience, but to do something. At the ordination that afternoon, after each person had hands laid on his head, and there were only men ordained, a congregation came up, all dressed in the same shirts, and danced this ordinand down the huge aisle and back up again, while everybody just applauded. It was wonderful to be there. These people had come to do something, do you see? And the presiding minister in this church in Soweto, Holy Cross, didn't pick the hymns. Somebody in the choir would yell out a hymn in four languages and four different versions, and then the organist would start it up and the choir would lead the singing. In short, people came to do their liturgy on Sunday. I was a visitor, and it was a powerful witness to me, A, what the church is, and B, what the gospel is. You see, that's what they were saying. We ended with the meal at both of these services. I was in church all day that day, and it didn't seem like being in church because it was very exciting. These people came to do something. Now, so when we worship, we witness. I think that's the first thing to be said. The people who come to find out what's going on need to encounter church. They don't need to encounter an audience sitting back and seeing whether they like it or not. They need to encounter church. And they need to be drawn into whatever it is that we have come to do. So the liturgy is what we do. It belongs to the congregation. Doesn't belong to the pastor or the musicians. It belongs to the congregation. And one of the ways we signal this is by having the laity, the laos, the people, take charge of their liturgy on Sunday. At Trinity, we try to train seminary students not how to be presiding ministers, but how to be assisting ministers. That's the little A word in the Lutheran Book of Worship. I don't know what it is in some of the other traditions. But the assisting minister is really the one who's in charge of the liturgy. And it is a member of the congregation who points in the book and says, now do this, now do this. When I go visiting and preaching on Sunday mornings to parishes, I'm often there when the pastor is not there. And it's wonderful to come to a congregation where the people are in charge, where they just tell me, go sit in the sacristy. We'll tell you when we're ready for you. And then the assisting minister says, now do this, and I do that. But it's quite clear that they are in charge. They are not only in charge of the Sunday liturgy, they are in charge of the mission of the congregation. If you want to have the congregation exercise its priesthood, the way it exercises its priesthood is by doing the liturgy. I'm going to tell you about Grace Church in Raleigh, North Carolina. I was there on a Sunday, and it was wonderful. They have only one liturgy, big room, lots of people in it, hundreds of people, the assisting minister in charge of the liturgy. When they came to the prayers, everybody sat down. I said, why are we sitting down? It's time for the prayers. Then I began to understand. The assisting minister is now calling for members of the congregation, A, to make announcements, and B, scribbling down things while the announcements are being made that later turned up in the prayers. Do you see? What was announced? Everything that was important to this congregation. I was there at the height of the controversy over the Nicaraguan Contras. Do you remember that? How long ago that was? Well, this congregation was in the middle of an argument about that, and they had sent three members of the congregation down to Nicaragua. They were back now, raised their hands, made an announcement that they were ready to report and that they were meeting on Tuesday night. Everybody should come, and they were going to have it out on the basis of having been to Nicaragua. Whew, I thought, What a thing for a congregation to do. It was not turned in upon itself. It cared about what was going on in the world. That was the biggest thing going on in the world at that time. People would announce births, marriages, deaths, and the assisting ministers busy scribbling all this down. People on the church council announced meetings. Assisting minister is still scribbling things down. And finally, I said, what does all this have to do with the prayers? This is announcements. This is business. But it dawned on me that praying is a part of the congregation's business. And all of these things got transformed then by taking them up in the prayers, you see. Who the sick were. We didn't just have a list of people in the bulletin. They got named, and they got named twice, in the announcements and in the prayers. That's partly why the liturgy took so long. The congregation was doing its thing. What was the pastor doing? He was sitting there listening to all of this. I thought, how wonderful. You know, that's exactly what the pastor ought to be doing, because the congregation was doing its thing. Do you see? Oh, my. Now, what is the structure of this thing that we do? Let me try to put it quickly on the board. The first thing is we gather. It is important that we come together. Robert Worley wrote a book called A Gathering of Strangers. He says we come together on Sunday mornings and we haven't fussed with each other all week. So we really do come together as strangers. We need to connect with each other and reconnect with each other. Gathering is to do that. The gathering begins in a space where you can have coffee and where you can stand around and talk. One of the things I noticed is that we built our buildings in America with very dinky little entrance porches. Why? because we were modeling them after European churches, but the European church sits on the town square. Go to the cathedral at Freiburg in Germany, and on Sunday morning you will see flower shops and vegetable shops and all kinds of souvenir shops set up in the big square in front of the cathedral, and people milling around, talking to each other, getting reacquainted with each other, and then the bells start ringing, and they move from the flower shops and the souvenir shops into the churches. What we didn't do in this country was build our churches on the village square. And we don't have all this stuff going on Sunday morning. So we have to build bigger porches. We don't need one for the village center because we all live here. We see each other. We sit in the ark. When the bell rings at 7:30 on Sunday evenings, we just walk from wherever we have been in communion with each other to the place where we're going to do the meal. But our churches, our buildings, need coffee bars, need spaces where we can gather. We ought to move easily from the parking into the space for gathering. And then the bells ring or the organ chimes or whatever, and we keep on gathering as we come together now to do what we have come to do. We have connected with each other. That's partly what the gathering ritual needs to be. It doesn't have to be the litany or the hymn of praise or whatever. It can be whatever it is that we need to have done in order for us to connect together, to be reconnected. And it also needs to identify more or less who we are and what we have come together to be. There's a lot of optional stuff that we can do as part of our gathering ritual, but the main thing is get us connected with each other and get visitors connected with somebody so that they aren't just sitting there wondering what in the world is going to happen now. However we organize that, that's what gathering is about. Secondly, attention to the word. Lessons from scripture, strange lessons which need introductions often, and proclamation. I was in East Germany for 3 months in 1985, and they did services of music and meditation in churches at 6 o'clock on Friday evenings. People streaming out of the stores, going to the great St. Thomas Church in Leipzig. I turned to a young man after one of those services and I said, "Do you belong here?" And he, "Oh no, wir sind nicht kirchlich, I'm not churchly, I don't belong." I said, "Why do you come?" Oh, he said some strange things to me. He said, "Coming here is to discover an island of truth and freedom. To come to this place," he said, "is like emigrating without leaving the country." And I thought, my God, what if that could be said about our churches, you see? An island of truth and freedom. Attention to the word is a way of saying what we are about. It is no accident that the churches in East Germany turned out to be the seedbed which tore down the wall, finally, in 1989. In Berlin. And it was out of the churches that people streamed to these mass rallies.